Welcome in to a late night Tuesday night edition of the Locked On Nets podcast, where we are reviewing Rondae Hollis Jefferson's season. We are going to tell you how he completely revolutionized his offensive game and turned himself into one of the stronger mid-range scorers in the NBA, certainly the best on the Brooklyn Nets. And we're going to tell you where he can improve this offseason, and then we will finish up with some coach talk, courtesy of our Locked On Pistons and Locked On Raptors experts, talking about the hires of Dwayne Casey and the man who's replacing Dwayne in Toronto, Nick Nurse. All that and more next on the Locked On Nets podcast.
You are Locked On Nets, your daily Brooklyn Nets podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Welcome in to Locked On Nets, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. I am your host, Gavin Shaw. After 4 years covering the Phoenix Suns, I am back in my native New York to cover your Brooklyn Nets. And I am joined, as always, by the great Josh Bass. Josh, how's it going?
Can we even say that it's as always? Because I feel like I'm only here for half or two-thirds of the episodes.
No, I know, but I got lazy, and now I only record when you're free because it allows me to justify not doing it that often. So
now get you're inside baseball.
Now you're here.
For the fans here.
You're here. You're here a little more. Anyways, we don't need to talk about that. We're going to talk about Rondae Hollis Jefferson's season. Before we get into reviewing a season, though, I wanted to mention that RHJ is writing a, I believe, weekly, maybe monthly blog for BrooklynNets.com. He wrote the first one, took some shots at Jalen Rose, not even mentioning his name. He talked about the Cali trip, and he was really emphasizing that it was no one was coerced into going. They all went because they genuinely enjoy each other's company, even D'Lo. And that the expectation for next season is that they improve by at least 8 games, as they did the previous year. So that was maybe the only really interesting nugget in there, though. It was cool to read, and I'm looking forward to getting some more insights into Rondae's offseason.
Yeah, Rondae is honestly one of the funniest and just most charismatic people that the Nets have had in a while. So I think if anyone's doing a blog or a vlog, sorry,
it's probably
be Brooke Lopez.
Yeah.
And number two, RHJ. So we got the second best person.
Right.
And considering Brooke's not on the team anymore, probably the best person.
I think it'd be funny if they like made Jared Allen do it, because he just, I mean, maybe I'm reading too much into just like a few interviews I've seen with him and his body language on the court, but he just seems like generally like a nice, quiet guy who likes to keep to himself. So I'd love it if they just like made him write like a 1,000-word blog every week.
And he just wanted to build his computers. That's all he wants to do in his spare time.
That's it. Him and Andrew Bynum grinding together in the computer lab. Yeah.
Did Andrew Bynum do that?
He did. He loved to build computers, and people were,
he loved to bowl and build computers.
Yeah, it was and get weird haircuts in Philly. I remember it was like a story, like how people think of like NFL players right now in the dark ages of the NBA. People were like, can he build computers and be a great NBA center? The answer was no, ultimately, though. You could argue injuries had to do with that. Anyways, all right, let's get into it. Rondae Hollis Jefferson season. So Hollis Jefferson pretty much shocked me the first couple games of the season. Like, I was obviously really surprised by what Dinwiddie was doing, but I remember when you and I were watching Summer League together, I kind of saw the makings of it. I was like, Dinwiddie's this like really skilled guy. He can shoot well enough to stay on the floor and play like a modern point guard. He's an incredible feel for the game. So I'd be lying if I said I saw the season that he had as an inevitability, but at least the skill set was there for something like that to happen with a larger workload thrown on his shoulders. Hollis Jefferson, we watched him in Summer League, and his offensive game, frankly, didn't look dramatically more advanced than it was when he first came out of Arizona. He was flubbing passes. His shot looked totally broken. He was turning the ball over every time he tried to take two or three more dribbles. And I remember talking to you about it, like a guy who had actually watched him before, and you were like, yeah, like, I don't know. I thought he'd be better at this point. Like, it might be time to let go if he can't figure out by the season. And then, like, first 4 or 5 games of the year, he's the Nets. I think he was, like, their second or third leading scorer, certainly, like, after Lin went out, he was in that category. And he had this really advanced mid-range game, like this beautiful touch on his jumper from about 12 to 16 feet out. Could use that jumper to get a defender off guard and take advantage of his quick first step, was really good finishing. He looked like a poor man's Melo all of a sudden, and frankly better than the current version of Melo, which was shocking given with what we started from last year. So that was just such a surprise to start the year.
Yeah, he definitely turned it on, I think, a lot quicker than all of us expected. And really, after his first two seasons, my thought was that if he were to be an impact player in this league, it would be honing things like his defense, his rebounding, kind of just working on those intangibles, like a Draymond Green type player. But he really did a great job this year of establishing himself as not someone that's going to be a primary option on offense, but definitely someone that can be a secondary or tertiary option, and someone that can really lead an offensive unit, especially coming off, if he were to come off the bench on a better team. Definitely was someone that was a very reliable shot creator, something that the Nets desperately lacked. And I think that going forward, if he can continue to improve on that, maybe extend his range a little bit, and I think that's a question that we're going to touch on if that's feasible or not, but also in addition to his defense and his rebounding, just like how much more energy the team seems to play with when he's on the court, I think he's it's proven to be the case that he's a positive player for any team he's on.
Yeah, I'm not sure if this is going to be the case going forward. I tend to assume that he'll start next year, but when him and Karis came back from injury, and it might have just been because the Nets were so depth depleted at that point, like any talented player coming off the bench would have really made a significant difference. But I love the energy him and Karis brought to the second unit, and those two getting to play off each other as the two main guys. Like, I actually really, really enjoyed that, and it kind of broke up the guys on the Nets that can isolate and do work by themselves to D'Lo and I guess sometimes Dinwiddie in the starting unit, and then Karis and RHJ off the bench. And I liked having that diversity, and I think diversity is a good word to describe what Hollis Jefferson brought to the Nets. He obviously played with more effort defensively, though there was a small drop off there, and we'll talk about that, than a lot of guys on the team. And offensively, his game was truly unlike any other player on Brooklyn, just because of the way the team is built. They emphasize either getting layups or threes, and in a poor man's version of what Chris Paul brought to Houston this year, Hollis Jefferson allowed them to mix it up a little bit and score a different way. As far as the statistics go, despite his usage being up pretty dramatically than his first two seasons, he still found a way to get more efficient, shooting 4% better from the field, 4% better from three, and that resulted in him averaging 5 more points per game, an extra rebound, and up half an assist from last year. And I thought his passing was noticeably better at all as well. So it just felt like he was able to take at the very least a small jump in every aspect of his game, and a big jump in his face-up game, at least in terms of offensive output.
Yeah, the face-up game was huge for him. I mean, just having that reliable 14 to 16-foot shot that he can go to any time. And then also, he was so much better at finishing through contact this year. Whenever he would put the ball on the floor, his first two seasons, I was thinking to myself, oh my God, he's about to lose it. I mean, he just has no handle. And did it look pretty this year? Absolutely not, but it was effective. I mean, I can't think of how many times he grabbed a rebound, pushed the ball in transition, dribbled through four or five guys, and I almost had a heart attack thinking he would lose it on three or four separate occasions, and somehow he'd finish with an and one. So yeah. I don't know how he was doing it, but it was effective.
Yeah, he's like, he reminds me of like there'd always be like that kid you'd play with growing up that like hadn't totally harnessed his skill set yet, but was just like stronger and more athletic than everyone, and would just go kind of like a bowling ball. And I think you described it perfectly. Like, the handle would look loose, but they always know like that type of player, like exactly where the ball is going to end up and like exactly what their margin for error is. And they just seem to find a way to like almost use that looseness of handle to their advantage to draw a defender out of position and then take advantage of it. Like, I was just watching Hollis Jefferson highlights to prepare for this pod, and there were like a bunch of different times where he'd draw a guy out with that like seemingly loose handle and then put together this really like tight spin move and totally blow by them. And then he had that nice ability to finish with either hand on either side. And again, like, I invoked the Melo, the super poor man's like prime Melo comparison before, and just his combination of strength, first step, mid-range touch, and coiled athleticism, it really does make me think of someone like Melo. And I guess the reason the Melo's the first guy I bring up is just because there aren't that many guys with that type of game anymore. So it was really fun to watch him work. And I really, I made a mention of it before, but I really do like what he did with his passing ability this year. And it was something that only flashed on occasion, and I think more so towards the end of the year. But he started making reads on the move, which with his inability to shoot threes, I think that's a necessary component of his game to come along for him to continue to be a productive offensive player in the Nets system. He has to be a really, really smart passer because he's going to operate in much tighter spaces than most guys on the team are. And I think he started to develop that as the season went on.
Yeah, he's always had good passing vision. I think it's the matter of being in control and being able to make a good quality pass as opposed to just having the right idea but throwing it out of bounds. And I think to the point you mentioned, 47 and ones this year, doubled what he had in 2016-17. So just doing a great job of getting to the basket, being able to finish through contact. And also he improved his free throw percentage by about 4% up to 79%, which for someone like him that doesn't have the cleanest mechanics or the most natural touch is pretty good.
Yeah, no, absolutely. All right, and just to kind of wrap up this initial segment on the Locked On Nets podcast, he shot 59% from 10 feet and in, and the issues came when he went further out on that. We are going to touch on that and more in our next segment when we talk about what Hollis Jefferson has to improve on this offseason. Attention cancer victims, if you or a loved one lived, worked, or visited Lower Manhattan in the months after the 9/11 attacks and have been diagnosed with cancer, federal benefits and health care may be available. Attorney Eddie Markowitz has helped many families recover substantial benefits from the September 11th Victims Compensation Fund. The James Zidroga Health and Compensation Act has been extended, but time is limited. Attorney Markowitz is proud to serve as counsel to the Zidroga family. Let him help you too. These benefits are not just for rescue workers, but to anyone who qualifies. The fund covers many cancers, including prostate, skin, lung, and breast. Please call 1-800-LAW-HELP. That's 1-800-LAW-HELP to see if you qualify. Thanks for joining us back on the Locked On Nets podcast. We are going to talk about the aspects of Hollis Jefferson's game that he has to improve on this offseason. And I feel like this is kind of cheap because I really am essentially saying it for every player, but you go up and down the board and you look at how the Nets want to play, shooting more threes than anyone in the league outside of the Houston Rockets. It is a big deal that everyone gets better shooting from outside, and that might not be, I'd argue D'Lo in this area too, but it's him and Hollis Jefferson in terms of the guys that skill acquisition is most important for. Hollis Jefferson still pretty much utterly incompetent from three-point range. I believe he shot just 28% from there this year. That was generous. He shot 24% from three-point range this past season. Do you think it's feasible he improves in that area, or he just has to keep ironing out the other parts of his game? That's never going to happen, Josh.
I mean, I think at some point it's possible. I think with his mechanics, they're so difficult to repeat, and it's so much effort that goes into his shot. I just don't know if he's ever going to be a consistent three-point shooter. And I think it would be really beneficial if he kind of got proficient from the corners, shot 9 of 27 on threes this year from the corners, but I'm not sure. I feel like from my just kind of watching him for an 82-game stretch, I always felt like he was more comfortable shooting from the top of the key or the sides, the corners, but he was actually only 4 of 20 from the wings and the top of the key. But I don't really ever see him being a credible three-point shooter. I think if he could even be decent from the corners, then it would really help to unlock his drive and kick game and also being able to finish at the basket with more space. But I think we have to wonder if he's ever going to be there because he wasn't a three-point shooter at all in his 2 years in Arizona and then has shown no indication of being able to develop that in his 3 years in the pros.
Yeah, no, and I think the concern with changing his mechanics, and I don't know if that's something he's even really thinking about, is that he was so good in that mid-range area, and for whatever reason, his slingshot kind of release, it looks really good from 16 feet out, but then, and I think that's because it's more of a flick from there, but when he goes out to three-point range and he has to put a little bit more leg into it, it kind of messes up the rhythm he gets into from closer in, and he was essentially left wide open from three against other teams. And it was almost like a playoff-style defense, like what the Warriors used to do against someone like Tony Allen, what a lot of teams do against Marcus Smart when they play the Celtics, where they were just willing to give him all the room in the world. And he still shot terribly on wide-open three-pointers. I think the final stat on the year, on shots where he was open by 6 feet or more, he shot 34%, and that's including like fast-break layups he got and more. So I'd imagine from three, it was probably quite a bit worse than that. So it doesn't really seem feasible that he's ever going to develop that shot as a big part of his game. To me, the bigger thing is, can he regain the defensive ability he showed when he first broke into the league? His steals have gone down every season. And while steals in and of themselves aren't necessarily indicative of great defense, I generally do think there's a correlation between that and activity. And his steals haven't gone down dramatically, but when you consider his minutes have gone up every year, I think that's something of a troubling trend.
Well, his steal rate has actually been cut in half since his rookie season.
Yeah, there you go.
He was just phenomenal. I mean, he did a great job of making impact plays through steals and blocks while also being able to stay in front of his man and contest. And when you have both of those traits, that's when you're an elite defender like a Kawhi Leonard type. And I think now is this past season, he wasn't a bad defender, especially compared to the rest of the Nets. I think he was pretty good, but he wasn't necessarily impactful. And you're looking for those impact players, especially when you're never going to be a fully formed offensive player because of those limitations on your jump shot.
Right, and I guess the natural follow-up to that is he was generally playing a lot of power forward. Is that the right position for him to guard? Should he be guarding centers even and playing big? And or with all the switching that goes on in the modern NBA, does it even matter who his initial matchup is? Like, what do you think about that?
I think he's... Yeah, I mean, it's definitely lessened the degree of how important your initial matchup is, but I think it is still important. And we saw when he was playing the five, the Nets would just get killed on the board. So I don't think that's necessarily tenable. I think the best probably position for him to guard is threes, just because he has the size, the strength, the quickness to match up with them, especially the best players in the league. But unfortunately, on offense, he really would need to play the four. Yeah. You need to find someone that can play the three on offense and the four on defense. There's kind of having two switchable combo forward types. Maybe that's Damari Carroll. Maybe it's someone with a little bit more off the dribble juice, but we'll see.
Yeah, it was interesting because I know in his Nets profile they were talking about his defense, and he was saying it was a big adjustment to guard fours, and he referenced Paul Millsap, and I understood that, but it also kind of caught me off guard because I feel like him having to guard someone like Millsap is like the exception rather than the rule, because the majority of teams aren't playing two big guys. So he should like theoretically like over like maybe I'm underestimating the size of most stretch fours, and it is still just bigger guys that can shoot. But it'd be interesting to like go just like team to team and like map out like who he'd be guarding on a game to game basis, because I bet in general like he's not at like a massive size advantage, and even the times who we are, those players tend to be more finesse oriented. So I don't know if that's really like a legitimate excuse for his drop off on defense.
Well, I think the problem is that even though like there are exceptions, he's not going to be going up against a Kristaps Porzingis, or he's not going to be going up against Anthony Davis every night. But at the same time, even if he is going up against someone that's more of a combo forward type, RHJ is only 6'7". I mean, he plays bigger than his size, but even guys that are 6'9 or 6'10 and have muscle are going to give him problems. So I'm thinking of someone like a Serge Ibaka. I mean, he's at a huge size disadvantage there, even though Ibaka's not the type of player to really back you down and post you up, and few power forwards are in this league anymore. It still is draining to have to guard someone for 20 or 30 minutes a night that has that much of a size advantage on you.
Yeah, no, that's certainly fair. And I'm wondering if like another part of it, not to go too deep down this rabbit hole, is just given that the Nets have so many other poor defenders on the floor, and this is something you'd have to go back and watch a lot of film on to confirm, like maybe he's getting involved in pick and rolls less, and the guy he's guarding is staying more in the corner to just not even bring him into the play when you have so many other options for guys to target. Like, I mean, it's like obviously even like someone like Jared Allen, who like down the road, I think we both think is going to be very good to great defensively, but right now is still just a rookie and would like mess up on pick and roll coverages or wouldn't be big enough to stop a guy yet. So perhaps it was just part of it was a matter of opportunities. But I think we both got the sense that he was a step slower last year and was a little bit more focused on offense than he'd been in the past, and then that impacted him on the other end.
Yeah, I agree, but also I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I mean, I think that we're at the stage where any skill development for the Nets is precious, and you just have to hope that they'll regain that defensive intensity and also pair that with the newfound offensive skill.
All right, no, that's fair enough. All right, final question for you, and this is the big one before we wrap up our portion of this podcast. Do you think he's a part of the Nets' future, because on one hand, he does provide that diversity to the ecosystem that I think is pretty healthy on an NBA team to have someone who just does something completely different than the rest of your team. And when those three-pointers aren't falling, I really think he's a useful guy. But at the same time, him and to a lesser degree, if you were to be listened to almost a non-degree, Jeremy Lin are the only real trade assets the Nets have that they seem readily willing to part with. Obviously, if they got a great deal, they'd ship someone like Dinwiddie out in a second. But they seem like the two guys most likely to be traded. So how long do you think he's on this team, and should he be a part of this team going forward?
I'd love to have him on this team moving forward. I think that it depends on what he's going to be looking for in restricted free agency after, I guess, summer of 2019. If he's only looking for $10 million a year, $10, $12 million a year, definitely want him as part of the core moving forward. I think if we're starting to look at $15 million, that's when we have to reevaluate possibilities. And I don't think it's something where I would look to trade him at this coming draft. I think it's, you have to see how he progresses this year, see how the team fits together, kind of get a better sense of what he's going to be looking for in free agency. And then maybe if you think his demands are unrealistic, see what you can get for him at the trade deadline next year when a team might covet his restricted rights.
All right. No, I think that's a good call. I don't really have much to add to it other than tomorrow, the Locked On NBA mock draft drops, which I believe is probably our most listened to episode of Locked On NBA year in and year out. It's a pretty unique opportunity to get insight on all 30 teams and what their thinking is heading into the NBA draft. And then for the college perspective, have a true expert review each and every one of those picks in Sports Illustrated's Jeremy Wu. So if you want to hear him roast our pick, which I will not spoil for you, so you go listen to it, tune in to Locked On NBA tomorrow. And the connection to this podcast is we are going to talk about a scenario where Rondae Hollis-Jefferson gets dealt for a higher pick. So tune in and check that out. We are going to take one final break and then come back with Locked On Pistons Matt Scotch on the Pistons hire of Dwayne Casey, and then Locked On Raptors Sean Woodley on the Raptors hire of their former assistant coach, Nick Nurse.
Well, they finally did it. This is Matt Shook from Locked On Pistons, where Detroit now has a new head basketball coach, hiring Dwayne Casey on Monday and signing him to a 5-year deal. The former Toronto Raptors leader, a finalist for this season's NBA Coach of the Year, will make just over $35 million over the course of the deal. The Pistons were also looking at Ime Udoka, the Spurs assistant, and Michigan coach John Beilein until the latter pulled out of consideration late last week. The Pistons were criticized for taking nearly a month after the season to fire former coach and president of basketball operations Stan Van Gundy. Similarly, this hire was made 34 days after Stan Van Gundy's departure and just 10 days before next week's NBA draft. Also complicating matters is that the Pistons don't have a general manager or most of the front office in place yet, with veteran Ed Stefanski running the show as a powerful advisor to owner Tom Gores. Stefanski was working with former Toronto executive Brian Colangelo when Casey was hired by the Raptors in 2011. Casey had a nice run in the North, taking the team to 5 straight playoff appearances and winning 59 games and the East top seed this past season. However, 3 straight playoff exits against LeBron James and the Cleveland Cavaliers ended Casey's run in the 6, a move to shake things up without tinkering with the core of a talented guard-led roster. In Detroit, he'll have the challenge of a unique roster led by high-priced frontcourt players in Blake Griffin and Andre Drummond. Casey could also be without his right-hand man, as Toronto offensive assistant Nick Nurse, credited with revamping the attack this past season, is the main candidate to replace him in the big seat in Toronto, according to Locked On Raptors host Sean Woodley on our Monday show. In Detroit, there's limited roster flexibility and the baggage of a decade of futility since the end of the going-to-work glory days. It's a tough crowd around Detroit these days, as most of the team's former fan base sees a rebuild as the best path forward. Gores seems uninterested in that again, with $35 million to a veteran coach becoming the latest evidence that the owner is full speed ahead. Casey was the best option out there, especially considering a wild search that included Kenny Smith and Jason Kidd, rumored candidates who were received in Detroit about as good as a foreign car. As a singular move, it's a good one, hiring Casey, although the Pistons had to pay a tax of sorts in the form of an extra year in the deal to get their guy because of the malaise around the franchise. Similarly, it was the only way to get Stan Van Gundy 4 years ago, giving him the front office control back when that was a common move around the league. How you feel about the Blake Griffin trade in January probably colors how you feel about this move, but from where I sit, this team is in better position for success than they were in January. The Pistons will now be burdened with not only living to the promise of getting back to the playoffs, but proving to critics that they can advance past the perceived ceiling of also-rans, a challenge Casey couldn't push through before. But, for better or worse, he'll have a few years to get it done in Detroit. This is Matt Shook from Locked On Pistons.
Hey, what's up? It's Sean Woodley from Locked On Raptors, and the Raptors have hired a head coach after a month of waiting, a long, exhaustive search in which they interviewed a whole wide range of candidates, ranging from Sarunas Yasikevicius to Ettore Messina. They have landed with a guy who was in front of their faces all along, assistant coach, five-year assistant coach under Dwayne Casey. Nick Nurse has been named head coach of the Toronto Raptors. It's an interesting move. It is, you know, I think a lot of people, Raptors fans' initial reaction was that it was kind of not the right move. I think a lot of people kind of were hoping for a new outside voice to come in, considering you fired Dwayne Casey, who's an excellent head coach, who did a lot of great for this team. And if you're going to fire him, then maybe it's only a half measure to hire the assistant coach. I kind of disagree. I think Nick Nurse has a lot of potential. He's coached for 30 plus years. He coached in England. He's a two-time D-League Coach of the Year and also was the architect of the Raptors' brand new offense this season. You know, it got a lot of headlines. It got a lot of press on how the Raptors kind of changed the way they play offense, and it was a top five offense in the regular season, and it was the second best offense by offensive rating in the postseason. For the first time in 5 years, offense is not what let the Raptors down in the playoffs. It was defense, and that is probably more under the purview of Dwayne Casey and other assistant coach Rex Kalamian. Nick Nurse was the offensive coordinator. So he is going to be tasked with sort of redefining how this Raptors team plays defense. And maybe it is just a limitation sort of implied by the players on the roster, but Nick Nurse is going to be tasked with sort of trying to find a new way for this team to play defense while also upholding the offense that it really maintained this season and showed that it can work in the playoffs despite maybe having some sort of limitations built in with guys like DeMar DeRozan running so much of the offense. A good thing about this move is that Nick Nurse already has a lot of institutional knowledge with the Raptors. He's been here 5 years, of course. He reportedly, from all accounts, has a great relationship with Kyle Lowry, which was always going to be a pressure point for any new coach coming in. It was always going to be necessary for that coach to be able to establish a relationship with Kyle Lowry, who notoriously has not been the easiest guy to coach in the world. And he even famously said when Dwayne Casey was let go that they never really saw eye to eye, but they still made it work and they forged a good relationship there. And it's good, at least in my mind, that Nick Nurse is coming in with an established relationship with Kyle Lowry. Whereas if you come in with a new guy, maybe that relationship never really blossoms. And that's just a big risk with your best player who's still here for two more years on $30+ million a year. The other thing too with the Raptors is that they're in a pretty good spot considering all things. They're a 59-win team coming off of 59 wins with a one seed. They've made the playoffs 5 years in a row. Maybe they didn't need a big giant change to sort of shake up the entire room. Maybe a subtle move like this with Nick Nurse, he can sort of bring in his own ideas that maybe got suppressed under a guy like Dwayne Casey. Not to say that Dwayne Casey suppressed ideas, but you know, any person who is under a boss and eventually gets promoted, in theory, would like to do things differently than the previous boss. And there are things that they wish they could improve on and that they want to improve on when they get the opportunity. And I would assume we're going to see that from Nick Nurse. All reports are that he's a more experimental guy and sort of an outside-the-box thinker who I think will probably get the most out of sort of a strange roster the Raptors have, and hopefully maybe sort of use the regular season as a bit more of a testing ground for the playoffs as opposed to Dwayne Casey, who really sort of went out for a lot of wins in the regular season. And that's not a bad thing by any means, but at the Raptors' point in their win curve, I think it's more about trying to use the regular season as an establishing ground for what you're going to do come playoff time. And maybe Nick Nurse and his sort of experimental nature can kind of work on that and get the Raptors a little bit more prepared for what postseason basketball brings. Either way, I'll have a lot more about this on the next episode of Locked On Raptors. It should be out by now if you're hearing this. So tune into Locked On Raptors. This is about 30 minutes talking about the brand new Raptors head coach, Nick Nurse. We go in depth on the good stuff, the concerns, the bad stuff, and sort of the optics of it. Tune into Locked On Raptors to hear that. And thank you for listening.